Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 23 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you today?
Hey, man, I'm doing well.
Except for traffic.
Traffic, I tell you what, I can't stand traffic.
Now, Gibby's late because he got stuck in traffic.
If it's not traffic, it's the people that get in the fast lane that drive slow. Can't stand that either.
You're just waving a K-bar at them.
That's
saying,
right.
Get out.
So if you're one of those folks,
get out.
If there's people behind you and nobody in front of you, you're in the wrong lane.
All right. So let's start with, we got some shout outs today. Patreon supporters. We got Scott K, Deb from Missouri, Brandon K-Bell. And then we got Michelle Watson actually supported us through PayPal.
That's cool.
So that's cool.
Thanks,
as well.
Everybody.
Yeah. So again, I know we harp on it, but we appreciate everybody that supports us, the new folks, and especially the people that have been there from the beginning or continue to support us month after month.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it is very much appreciated. Hey, folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime, and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500.
You know, as always, check out our website, truecrimeallthetime.com. Our contact information's on there. We're getting a lot of emails about cases. And actually, the one that we're going to do today is one that's probably been requested, Gibbs, more than any other case since we started.
Well, that's cool.
Except for the really big ones.
Yeah.
Right? It's not Dahmer or Gacy. A lot of people say that. We're going to get to those, and we've talked about that, but we want to sprinkle those in, and we want to try to, you know, stick with some of the lesser known every now and then when we can, because a lot of people like those. Click on the merchandise page. The stickers are out.
They look good.
Yeah. Stickers are cool. They're like 4x4. With the True Crime All the Time logo.
If you get a sticker, take a picture and post it on our social media so we can see how it looks.
Yeah, and take a picture too, because I think that's important.
Either way.
Either one.
They both work.
So if you want to, you can help support us on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/truecrimeallthetime. And again, I would ask everybody using iTunes, if you would, if you love the show, go out and rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps us out a lot, especially, you know, with the charts, and allows other people to get a chance to see us.
If you don't like the show, don't rate us. That's, you know, this is my thought.
That's Gibby's thought.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, you know, check out our other podcast, True Crime All the Time, Unsolved. We just started a new Facebook page and a new Twitter to actually separate the two podcasts. You know, we had kind of been doing everything for both True Crime All the Time and Unsolved through one Facebook page and one Twitter. Now, if you go out to Facebook and just search for True Crime All the Time Unsolved, you'll find our new page. Like us, follow us there. And then the new Twitter handle is at TCAT Unsolved.
So like us there too.
Like us there.
Yeah.
Follow us.
Whatever it is. They know what to do.
We're not social media geniuses by any stretch.
That's for sure.
And I think a lot of people know this about us. We love the interaction, and we try to respond to every single thing we get. Whether it's an email, a tweet, instant message, whatever it is, we try really hard to respond to everybody that takes the time to reach out to us. All right. So I mentioned that this case is one that a lot of people have requested, and it's the case of Christopher Porco.
I was going to do a drum roll, but.
Okay.
But we're going to go with that.
We'll just go with the way I did it.
Yeah.
All right. I'm good with that. And, you know, for whatever reason, a lot of people were very interested in this case. And again, outside of the what we call the big timers, this by far has been the most requested case. And, you know, you and I kind of talked about it before we fired up the microphones that, you know, why? Why is that? Why is it so requested? Or right. Why is it?
What's the drive?
Yeah, what's the draw? Why do so many people want to hear about it? And again, it's an interesting case on its own. But then you throw in the killing of one's family.
Sure.
And I think that is just, I don't even want to use the word fascinating because I think that's a strange word, but it's so mind-boggling.
Well, you think when you're in your own home, you're safe.
Yeah. Well, I would say you're safe, especially from the people that you've raised.
Yeah, the people you love. You think that you're safe.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to worry about the ones that you love.
Yep. No doubt. No doubt about it. Let's talk a little bit about early life of Christopher Porco. I don't have a ton on him as much as we do in some of the cases, but he was born on July 9th, 1983. And really, by all accounts, Gibbs grew up in just a normal middle-class suburban household, parents intact. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Loving family. I mean, this is what everybody said. So this is so far away from what we normally talk about on most of the early lives.
Right.
Of the people we're talking about. But again, I think this is kind of a pattern because when we talk about a true serial killer, then that's when you see all of these. Now, there's going to be early warning signs here, but that's where you see them just growing up in a dysfunctional family and having all this trauma as a kid. But in the cases we've done where, you know, the person has just killed one person, and a lot of times it's a family member, you know, so I'm hearkening back to Scott Peterson. Oh, and the one we just did, you know, with Pam Smart. There's a pattern there where they didn't grow up in this really bad dysfunctional family.
No, they had a pretty normal life.
Yeah. And I think Christopher Porco was that same way. He had one brother named Jonathan.
Right.
And he was a U.S. Navy officer. And everybody just talked about, you know, this guy was just a fine, upstanding young man. But again, they grew up under the same house or in the same house,
right,
with the same rules and presumably had the same parental guidance.
Right. But they had issues.
Well, they did.
So Christopher liked to antagonize his brother. I mean, he would do things at an early age, like if his brother was playing with Tinker Toys, Legos, whatever, and he would build something. His brother would build these really nice structures out of these things, and he would just come along and, like, plaster them across the room just to be mean. And so some of his family members said this went on with a lot of different things. He didn't like to see his brother succeed in different things, so he would do little sabotage.
Yeah, and like we said, red flags, but, you know, that's a far cry from things we talk about.
By far.
Serial killers. Yeah. But some of that stuff is going to come out later in life with Christopher.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about it.
Bascom, please dispatch your Saginaw.
Hi, my name is Chris Porco. I was just called by the Times Union saying that my parents were found dead this afternoon. I was wondering if you had any information on me.
Hey, Chris, whereabouts are you?
I'm at school in Rochester, New York.
Okay, and are you in a dorm there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you have a dorm name, or?
It's called Monroe.
Okay. And you're hearing from the Times Union?
Yeah, they called me and said my parents were found, I guess. I don't know. They didn't say how or anything.
Let me try and find you somebody who may have some more information for you.
Okay. Now, as far as, when was the last time you said you came down and saw your parents?
About 3 weeks ago. It was on the weekend. I can give you a date. I have to figure it out. I'm not really sure.
Okay, but about 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Okay, and the email, what's going on with your email? You said you emailed him today, but you didn't get a response?
Yeah, I emailed him this afternoon. My dad at work.
Okay.
About college loan stuff.
Okay. You're going to go right to Albany Med?
I don't know. I don't even know where my mom is. But.
Yeah, she is at Albany Med.
Okay. Do you know her condition?
No, because I haven't talked to her. Let me give you my pager number.
Okay.
Because when you get there, I'll come and see if there's anything I can do for you.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Yeah,
so, we got to talk about this call. Because, you know, so to start it off, Christopher Porco gets a call from a newspaper basically asking him about his parents being attacked. And he calls the police department, which is what we just heard. But the thing that really strikes me, Gibbs, is his demeanor, tone. I mean, he could have been ordering a pizza from Domino's.
I was getting ready to say, you hear more excitement in my voice when I order my pizza.
Right. I mean, if somebody had called me and said, you know, some family member's hurt or they're in the hospital or anything like that, especially if somebody's possibly dead or in a life-threatening situation, I'd be frantic as all get out.
Exactly.
And he had just no emotion in his voice at all. So, I mean, I think that's got to be the first.
That's very alarming to me.
Yeah, the first thing that kind of pops out to me. So I guess from there, we just have to jump right into what happened that led up to this call. And it's Monday, November 15th, 2004. And Christopher's dad, Peter Porco, he had not reported to work that day.
Correct.
And obviously that's very strange for him. He was a court clerk. And because of that, they sent somebody from the court to check on him. Because I'm assuming this guy was punctual. He showed up every day. And so that was a big deal for him not to call or, you know, anything and just not show up. So they send somebody over there. And when the guy enters the home, this court officer discovers Peter dead. I mean, soaked in blood near the front door. Now, later, the medical examiner would come out and say that Peter had died from just a massive head trauma.
Right.
So I think what happened, Gibbs, is, I mean, this court officer, I mean, he sees Peter right away, and he immediately calls the police, right? So they get there, and that's when, obviously, they see Peter too, but they also discover Christopher's mother, Joan. You know, Joan, she was a speech pathologist for a local elementary school, and she's in the bed lying just in a, I mean, just drenched in blood.
Massive amounts.
I mean, that's the one thing about this crime is it was horrific in the amount of and type of injuries and the amount of blood. So she had also suffered severe head and facial trauma and ultimately would lose her left eye and part of her skull. I mean, really, really bad. Now, I got to play this clip about Peter because something very strange happens that they're able, the police and detectives, as they're there, they're able to piece Peter's movements that day. And it's just amazing.
Incredibly, at some point, Peter regained consciousness and got out of bed and went to the master bathroom. We can tell that he stood right in front of the mirror over the basin and bled. from the master bathroom. He went down the hallway, down the stairs, walked down the first floor hallway. It appears that Peter was wandering around trying to do his normal morning routine. Based on his injuries, I think Peter was in profound shock. He went into the kitchen and walked around, it appears, aimlessly, doing mundane things like trying to empty the dishwasher. He may even have been trying to make his lunch. We can tell that he opened the front door and at least poked his head out because there's drops of Peter's blood on the concrete porch out front. At some point, Peter collapsed at the base of the stairs and died.
So this is, I mean, amazing to me. So the police ultimately find an axe that belonged to the Porcos.
Right.
And it's very quickly, they're able to determine that that's the murder weapon. And so you have to think, Peter has been viciously attacked with this axe to the head.
Yeah, big fireman axe.
Yeah. I mean, this is not like a little hatchet. This is a big axe. And he's suffered all these massive head wounds. And at some point, like they talked about, he regains consciousness, is able to walk down the stairs, and in some kind of almost like he doesn't realize what's going on.
It's like he's in shock. I mean, clearly he's in shock.
Yeah. He's doing, making coffee, trying to empty the dishwasher, just doing like his normal routine, all the while just bleeding out from the head. And then you hear him talk about, at one point, he opens the door like he's going to head outside.
Yeah.
And blood's just dripping all over the concrete. And he must have shut the door and then just collapsed.
Just fell down.
I just find it amazing that with the amount of injuries that he suffered, because he dies not that long after.
Right. Yeah.
That he's able to get up and do all these things.
Make a sandwich.
It's amazing.
It's just weird how the body works. The mind pushes past that.
So let's hear from one of the detectives that was on the scene pretty quickly.
I just happened to be the one that went to that house. And everywhere I looked in the downstairs area, there was blood. I mean, it literally, there was blood all over the place. It was just a very, very bad scene. And I'm still trying to make, you know, my mind connect with the fact that Peter's laying there dead. Here was a person I knew with large hack marks in their skull. So I jump over Peter and run upstairs. I turn to look in the master bedroom, and the whole room was covered in blood. She was totally encompassed in blood. Totally. And her face was the same huge hack marks in her skull as her husband. It was probably the worst injuries I've seen, although I've seen some pretty bad ones. But I could honestly say that these are probably the worst. As I looked, I could see her hands moving, and I knew she was still alive. At the time, I felt it was personal. When I was checking the bottom floor of the house, I could see there was no break-in. There was no forced entry on the front door. But there was a key left in the door, a house key, which seemed strange at the time. I started getting the feeling that somebody that knows this place, you know, what does that boil down to? Could it be a friend? Could it be a close neighbor? Could it be a family member?
Pretty vivid descriptions, right?
It was.
Much better than we can do. This guy was on the scene. And there at the end, you start to hear him talk about some of the clues and of what would start to lead them down a certain path. So there's one more thing that happens while the detective is in the house, and it's going to be central to this whole case moving forward. As you hear him say, Joan's still alive,
right?
They know Peter's dead. Joan somehow is alive. And I don't know how, because by all accounts, she suffered just the most brutal just think about an axe blow multiple. I don't even know how many it was.
Yeah, to your face.
To your face and your head.
Right.
But what happens is that the detective is able to actually start to communicate with Joan.
Sure.
Which in itself is amazing.
I noticed a female laying crossways in that bed, and as I looked at her, she held her hand up and she was gesturing me over. I was amazed that she could do this. I walked over to her, looked down at her, and noticed these huge hack marks in her face. She could not speak, and I knew that the possibility is that she could die any minute. I asked her a series of questions, and amazingly, Joan Porco could answer the questions through head nods. And the answers that she gave me absolutely blew this case wide open. She did indicate to me who had done this to her. And I said to her, "Can you hear me?" And she nodded her head, "Yes." I then started feeling that this woman knows what's going on. I said, "Did a family member do this to you?" And she nodded her head up and down, clearly, "Yes." Now, everybody in the room stand there at this point. I've got witnesses. And I said to her, "Did Jonathan do this to you?" And she clearly shook her head back and forth, "No." At this point, I knew she could hear me. I knew she understood the answers, the questions. And I said to her, "Did Christopher do this to you?" And she then shook her head up and down. She nodded, "Yes. You did."
Now, why I say this is so central to the case, I say it for a couple of reasons. Number one, she implicates Christopher. Now, later on, they're going to try to discredit that because the thought is, was she even in a state where she could make that
right
distinction? But again, you listen to the detective and there are other witnesses in the room and she is saying no to one person and yes to another person.
And they're saying that she's doing this pretty easily. I mean, she's even moving her arms around when she's doing it.
Right. But the problem is, as we move along and as Joan recovers somewhat, I mean, she'll never recover fully.
Correct.
But as she starts to recover from her injuries, she does not remember this at all. And she stands by Christopher throughout this whole thing and backs him 100%. You know, springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. Springtime also means more time outside and away from home. And I trust SimpliSafe. I love the myriad of features that they offer. And I love the price. SimpliSafe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. The system blankets your whole home in protection. There are so many sensors, from detecting break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, they have a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day. So you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. There's no contract, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee. So you can try SimpliSafe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. SimpliSafe has given Gibby and I and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/TCAT. That's simplisafe.com/TCATT. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. All right, so Gibbs, at this point, I think they are already starting to focus on Christopher, the police, and they're starting to gather some evidence at the house.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at the house and they're realizing it doesn't really look like a break-in because, well, obviously, first thing they realize is that there's actual a key in the door.
Right, the detective said that.
Yeah.
So that's a big...
That's a big thing right there.
Yeah.
And then they also realize that the alarm code was deactivated with someone using the master code, which is another big sign. And then on top of that, it was strange to them because they were able to reach out to the security expert and they know what time the alarm code was shut off. But then hours later, somebody cut the phone cords. And they know what time the phone cords were cut because of the data feedback to the security office. So they know exactly when that occurred. The police detective also noted that Christopher's mom's purse was intact. Her wallet wasn't stolen. It was laying out on the countertop. The father's wallet was still laying on the dresser. So if this was an act of theft, right? I mean, and they were caught in the middle of trying to steal things, it didn't add up.
No.
But somebody tried to make it look like a crime because...
Well, it was a crime.
Well, yeah, a robbery. Someone tried to make it look like a robbery, but they did a really bad job at it.
Well, and I think, and we've talked about this in other cases, that's where a lot of people get tripped up.
Yeah.
Right? They think, oh, I know how to make something look like a robbery. The problem is the police are like 100 times smarter than you because they've seen it hundreds of times.
Exactly.
They know what real robberies and real crime scenes look like, and they're pretty good at spotting situations where people are trying to force it or make it look like it.
Right. And I think we had that last week on Pamela Smart.
So to me, that's a big deal, right? If somebody's going to come in and a random person is going to, first of all, how they get in the key. Second of all, how do they know the master alarm code? Now, they could cut the phone line, that they could do, but doing it after you've already...
Yeah, makes no sense. You know, I think someone does that because maybe they didn't want... I don't know. Why would you do that? And to me, it doesn't make any sense unless you thought someone was going to call after the fact, after you ran out.
And then I think the other thing is somebody that's coming in to rob... They're going to take jewelry,
right?
Items from the purse, cash, wallets. They're going to take all that stuff.
Yep.
Electronics. And the fact that they don't do that. So basically what you have is just somebody that came in random to wield an axe against two people.
Two people. Just doesn't make sense.
Why? So again, these are all the things that police are putting together and it's all pointing to Christopher as the best possible suspect at this point.
At this point.
Now, like we said, this happened on November 15th. It didn't take them very long because it's really just late November that they actually convene a grand jury to hear testimony about charging Christopher Porco in the murder. Right? Not very long, just a couple weeks. Now, there's a lot of people that are called to testify in this grand jury, and it was reported to be some of his friends from college, a safety officer from the college, a former girlfriend. So they're hearing all this grand jury testimony, but they don't indict Christopher Porco until November 2005. And that's a whole year after the attacks. And we're going to find out why. We're going to find out more of the evidence that they have against him as we go along. So, Gibbs, I think we need to revisit Joan Porco again. We mentioned the fact that after she heals up from the injuries, she's adamant that Christopher is not the one that did this. Now, she is called to the grand jury pretty early on, and she testifies about what happened to her that night, but she does not identify Christopher as the attacker. And she would go on months later to even write a letter to the Albany Times newspaper that basically said she's actually imploring the police and the district attorney's office to leave Christopher alone and to search for the real killer of her husband. So at this point, she's all in on Christopher's innocence. All right, Gibbs, let's get back to Christopher Porco and really talk about some of the things that police uncovered during the investigation. I think one of the things that they found out very early on is that there was a lot of tension between Christopher and his parents all around money. And some of this came out from a series of emails that somehow the press got, and it really showed some animosity between Christopher and his parents about some loans that he had taken out, number one, to pay his tuition at the University of Rochester, but also to finance a new yellow Jeep Wrangler. And this is really going to come into play, you know, as we move down the line. Now, Christopher didn't do all that well at the University of Rochester. He was actually forced or asked to leave during the fall semester of 2003.
Yeah, all in all, he really wasn't a good student even in high school.
Yeah. I mean, he was getting very poor grades. Now, he took a year off, and then he was readmitted the following year. And this is where he took out a loan of $31,000 to pay for his expenses, his school expenses. But in doing this, he forged his dad's name as a cosigner.
Yeah, so he did a few things wrong here. He left, took some time off, went back to the community college. Didn't do well there either. Forged a transcript to get back into Rochester. And along that same line, he forged his dad's signature to get the large student loan.
So really, less than 2 weeks before this all the murder happened and the attacks happened, Peter does confront Christopher about this forgery business. And he does this in an email, and he's basically saying, did you forge my signature as a cosigner? What the hell are you doing? I mean, these are some of the emails that come out. He's saying, you should have called me to talk about this, and I'm calling Citibank this morning to find out what you've done, and I'm going to tell them I'm not to be a cosigner. So some of this is starting to come out as these emails are leaked, or as the police get them, but they're leaked to the press too, I think, in some instances.
And they are. And there's a ongoing issue because this is an ongoing issue with him and his finances, because Christopher was late on making payments to his credit card accounts, and his dad was receiving notices about this and reaching out through email to Christopher, and Christopher's response was simply, oh, they're not late, Dad. I just got them set up on a different payment schedule. It's all good. It's cool. Don't worry about it. And he was like this with a lot of things with his dad. his dad got tired of reaching out to Christopher because sometimes Christopher would not even respond to the questions. So the dad just started paying some of these late notices.
Well, and I think at one point it was said that, you know, Christopher wasn't even responding anymore. He wouldn't answer their calls. He hadn't talked to them in a few weeks at one point. And this is when Peter sends Christopher another email, basically telling him that if you abuse my credit again, I'm going to file a forgery affidavit. And this is for, you know, the Wrangler. This is for the college loan. It's basically everything that Christopher's forged his name on. But the one thing that Peter says at the end of this email is really telling to me, because he's basically saying, you know, come home, let's talk about this. And at the very end, he says, you know, we may be disappointed with you, but your mother and I still love you and we care about your future. So I think that's important. You know, I mean, I think it says something about Christopher's parents that, yeah, they're pissed.
Right.
As any parent would be with a child that's done something that they shouldn't have done. But at the same time, they're telling him to come back and they're saying, we love you. We can work all this out.
Right. But you got to talk to us.
And you got to stop doing it.
Right. And even his mom tries to reach out to him and says, look, Dad's really upset. You need to get a hold of us about this.
All right, Gibbs. So we talked about the forgeries. Now we have to talk about what I guess we would have to call robbery. And this comes out during the course of the investigation. And this is where authorities, I think they're starting to see a pattern of Christopher with some antisocial behavior. And part of that is that they discover that he had burglarized his parents' home previously.
Yeah, a few years earlier to support his fake lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's one thing we haven't really talked about, right? One of the things that Christopher did is he tried to pass it off that he was from a wealthy family or that he was more well-to-do than what he really was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, big time. And I mean, so, he really elevated it up.
Yeah, and so a lot of these things that he's doing is, like you said, to support that.
Right. I mean, he's buying everybody's meal when they go out. Because he's acting like he has all this money that he can buy.
Like he's a high roller.
Yeah, yeah. When they go, you know, to parties, he's the kid that's getting in all the beer, right? Because he's got ways to do it because he's so wealthy, right? He's telling his high school friends that not only does he live in a big house and has a maid and someone cooks him meals every night, but he's also talking about how they have, you know, this vacation home that's just incredible, that something you see on MTV Cribs. Of course, a lot of the friends want to see his house, but it's never convenient for him to take anybody home.
Well, and he can't because
right. There's nothing to see.
The whole facade would crumble because, no, he lives in a nice house, a middle class,
absolutely
nice house, but he's not, it's not a McMansion.
No,
for sure. By any means. So back to this robbery, we'll call it, you know, what does he really end up taking? Some laptops, a camera. And by all accounts, he's trying to sell some, and does sell some of this stuff on eBay. At least one of the laptops, I believe. But here again, Gibbs, I mean, this is another example of where Christopher is making unbelievably bad choices, right? So he's stolen things from his family.
Sure.
And he's selling them on eBay. But then he doesn't send the items.
No, he collects the money.
Yeah.
But never ships out the items.
And his parents get notification because it's like some... It's like one big account.
Yeah.
It's not his own personal eBay account, I guess. And this is why where is the thinking? Because they freeze the eBay account immediately. And it gets even crazier because in the investigation, they find out that Christopher had posed as his brother and had gone as far as sending emails out to these people that were the winning bidders on eBay, right? Saying that his brother had died and was unable to send the things that they bought.
Yeah. Wow, what a story.
So he's pretending to be Jonathan, sending the email that he, Christopher, has died.
Right.
And therefore, we're unable to fulfill your purchase. And it wasn't just his parents' house. I mean, there was a lot of information out there that he had broken into former employers and stolen cell phones and cameras and computers. And
he was even at college, he was stealing his dorm mates' laptops, cell phones. He had one really good friend up there that said his laptop came up missing. And it was just days later that Christopher happened to have the same laptop, but he said he just bought it, but it was the same model, the same.
Yeah. Just shocking that all of a sudden mine's missing and you just go out and buy the exact same model.
Exactly. So
Gibbs, we've talked a lot about Christopher's behavior and a lot is made during this time about Christopher being a sociopath. And this really comes out from the police and looking at his pattern of behavior, because you got, you know, traits like egomania. He definitely was a pathological liar, a scammer. And again, it just seemed like going back to that call to the police, you could just tell from there. It just didn't seem like he had much remorse in his voice at all. Now, I think you have to be careful in analyzing people in those types of situations, but he showed nothing in that call.
For somebody that, I mean, I just can't imagine being that calm when you heard that type of news.
No, I can't either.
I don't see that.
So we know he lied about the car and the tuition payments and the loan that he got for both of those. There was somebody that worked with Christopher's dad, Peter, at the court that basically came out and said that Peter had described at times his son, Christopher, as a sociopath. So I think even Peter recognized it from all these things that were going on. And one of the things that you've already mentioned that psychologists would talk about that came out in the news was this pattern of lies that Porco told to convince everybody around him that he was, you know, rich.
Bigger than life
from this wealthy, influential family.
And he had no problem telling this. Like, it was true. I mean, he had no remorse lying to people, stealing nothing. And clearly, like we just talked about, he had no remorse when he called to find out about his parents' death.
Well, and this will come up in when the police are questioning him, right? Because they don't get anything out of Christopher. And basically it's said that one of the reasons police thought that they were not able to get anything out of him using their standard interview tactics is that because he was devoid of emotion, so his responses are different than most people would be because he didn't feel any remorse for what he had done. So he's not going to crack or he's not going to answer questions. He's not going to maybe be nervous the way that you and I would be if we were being interviewed by police for something bad that we had done.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, even the detective that interviewed him said that. I mean, he said that Christopher wouldn't make eye contact with him, just looked at the ground. And to the point, one time the police detective said, "Hey, Christopher, my eyes are up here. Try to get his attention to look up. And Christopher just didn't want anything to do with it.
Well, let's hear from Christopher.
I would never do something like that. I can't imagine attacking anyone, let alone my parents, in that way. It's just not who I am. It's a tragedy. Not really just for me, but for, you know, for my family. My mother's not going to have to live alone. And that's very, very hard for me to stomach sitting in here.
I don't get it from him. I mean, I don't get that it's hard for him to stomach. And maybe that's just the way he talks. But, I mean, there just is nothing there. That's the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, no emotions.
Just like it sounds empty and hollow to me when he talks about it.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
All right, Gib. So we've talked a lot about Christopher, his demeanor, some of his actions prior to the murder and the attack. One big piece that we have to talk about is how police are able to recreate Christopher's movements on that night of November 14th, 2004. So now what Christopher told them was that he was at the college at the University of Rochester, and in his dorm, he went to sleep and he woke the next morning. They didn't believe him. Now, what they thought is that he drove 3 hours to Albany in the very early morning of November 15th to murder his parents. One really interesting fact comes out of this, and that's that investigators are able to get with two people that work on the New York State Thruway Toll as collectors. And they report that they remember seeing a yellow Wrangler, which obviously matching the exact description of Christopher's Wrangler, passing through their station. So you have John Fallon, who's a toll collector at exit 46, and he tells the investigators that he saw a yellow Wrangler with large tires around 10:45 p.m., that night before on November 14th, right? So that completely contradicts Christopher saying, I went to bed. Then you have Karen Russell, another toll collector. She's at exit 24 in Albany. And she also tells the investigators that she sees a yellow Wrangler. And now we're at a time frame just before 2 a.m. And this is obviously the next morning, November 15th. And one of the reasons that she was so adamant about seeing it or remembering seeing it is because she says that it approached the toll plaza at what she called an excessive speed.
Yeah. I mean, she's got the time down actually at 1:51. That's how exact she remembers.
So it must have stuck out in her mind. Mm-hmm. But if you put those together, in that timeline, it has Christopher Porco traveling to Albany towards his parents' house, no doubt. Now, the other thing you have to talk about is the security cameras that they have at the college. because there's also footage that they record of a yellow Jeep Wrangler matching the description of the Wrangler that Porco drives, leaving the campus at 10:30 p.m. and returning at 8:30 a.m. the next morning. So, I mean, that really ties it together. If you've got the campus security footage and you match that up with the toll booth collectors, that timeline really fits.
Yeah, because the last toll booth, they actually have proof he went through at 8:18. And then, like you just said, they have him on camera at the university driving at 8:30.
So that's on the way back.
On the way back, yeah. It's pretty exact since they have the time of 8:18.
Yeah. And for then 12 minutes later for him to show up on the campus footage.
Right.
I'm sure investigators, that wasn't too hard to say. It takes about that long to get from this toll booth
to the campus
to pull in and be caught on camera. So things aren't looking good for Christopher right now.
No.
At all.
Coming back from the same direction, you know, you see him going back on campus. I mean, that is a huge piece of evidence.
But it doesn't show that I did it. They could have made a timeline for anyone to fit. There are millions of people all over the country who could have had their own little timeline that could have fit perfectly with the police's theory. And they chose to present the one that they made for me.
So there were millions of people that could have fit the same timeline that the police offered up.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah. So there's a million people with a yellow Jeep
that were at the University of Rochester caught on tape.
That looked like a 20-year-old white male.
Seen by two toll booth collectors.
Yeah. That could have been millions of people.
Millions.
Yeah.
Every time he opens his mouth, I like him less and less.
Yeah. I don't buy it. So the police also know that on 2 o'clock on Monday, the day of the murder, Christopher has a conversation with his girlfriend. And he tells her that he doesn't feel very well. During this time that they're talking online, his girlfriend receives a message from her sister, which is younger and is attending high school back where Christopher's from. And she tells her sister that Christopher's parents, one was murdered, not sure about the other one. She tells Christopher what her sister told her. Christopher doesn't respond until 3 p.m. when he sends a message saying, "My parents are dead."
So, Gibbs, this is all electronic, right? So the police are able to get this.
Right.
It's time stamped, all that good stuff.
Exactly.
So that's pretty strange to me, because if somebody had sent me a message and we'd been having a conversation, it wasn't like she sent it much later, right? They were actually in the middle of going back and forth. She sends that message and he just doesn't respond.
Exactly.
Very strange.
Very strange.
But he does a lot of strange things. You know, we talked about that he's indicted for the murder of his dad and the attack on his mom. So he's awaiting trial and he's acting just, again, very strangely. You know, there's a whole bunch of sightings of him tooling around town in his yellow Jeep, which obviously is probably all over the news. And how many yellow Jeeps are there? It's not that hard to figure out that that's probably Christopher Porco. You know, he's drinking in bars, he's going to concerts, he's going out with women, going to the movies and eating in expensive restaurants. He's basically just partying all the time. Now, keep in mind, he's awaiting trial. So what is the mindset there, that I have no remorse and I'm going to do whatever I want, or I'm probably going to be found guilty anyway, so I'm going to do whatever I want? I don't know what his mindset is.
Yeah, I don't know what he's thinking.
I mean, I would think again, I hate to put myself in position. I just think, you know, wouldn't you want to keep a low profile, keep out of sight, not be on the news?
And I wonder what the people, I mean, I know his mom paid for some of his bond, but then he also worked for this veterinarian's office, and she paid the majority of his bond. I just wonder what they're thinking, you know?
Well, they were convinced of his innocence. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at some of the documentaries, and I know that vet is on some of those.
Right.
Completely steadfast in the camp of Christopher is innocent.
Right.
But to me, all of these things that he's doing, it just goes into the whole sociopath, antisocial personality type of stuff. I mean, I think what people were saying is, you know, where is this grieving son who's devastated that his father is dead and his mother is so horribly injured that she'll never be the same
right
for the rest of her life? I think that's what people were saying.
Oh, I believe that.
Because he's out partying.
And maybe he was just living it up, thinking his days were numbered, because, I mean, the evidence was pretty strong. I mean, and we, you know, I forgot to mention that even the neighbor down the street, the morning of the murder, saw the Jeep in the driveway. So they even had that they could use at the trial.
So how's the Jeep going to be in the driveway if he's asleep?
Exactly.
Or, you know, just waking up at his dorm 3 hours away.
Right. So, I mean, with all that evidence, maybe he is just out winging it, saying, hey, my days are numbered. I'll be put away for a long time, so I'm going to live it up.
So we get into the trial, and obviously he's got defense, and they're going to mount a defense. The biggest thing that defense has going for them is that the police have no physical evidence linking Christopher to the attack on his parents. There were no fingerprints recovered from the fireman's axe. And basically what his defense attorney says is that the police department just zeroed in on Christopher. They thought he was guilty from the beginning, and they never looked at any other suspects. Now, you hear that all the time.
Right.
Now, sometimes that's true. And it's borne out in some of these cases where they go back and later find out that somebody wasn't guilty. And it's because the police had tunnel vision. They zeroed in on this person. They never followed all the other leads that would have led them to who the true killer really was.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that happened in this case. I'm just saying.
No, I mean, I know that they found.
It does happen.
They did find one fingerprint at the site. It was on the phone box outside where the phone lines were cut. One print, but they could never identify it to anything. All they could do is to say it wasn't Christopher's. But, I mean, it could have been a phone worker
right
when they installed the system. I mean, who knows?
And really, even if they did find fingerprints of Christopher, he lived there.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure his fingerprints were all over the house.
On everything.
Now, again, if they would have found it on the axe, that probably would have been
right
a little more.
Could have been, but even if it, like you said, what if he used the axe to chop some wood?
Moved it in the garage or
yeah.
just moved it from one
Still
place
Still makes it
to
hard.
Yep. You and I talk about fingerprints a lot because fingerprints are good, but not great. I mean,
yeah,
they just don't always tell a perfect story, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've been fingerprinted.
I'm sure you have.
For work.
Which is probably a bad thing, too, because they're probably running your prints through APHIS at all time.
Yeah.
There's probably a group somewhere just devoted to running
Gibby's prints. Yeah.
Just to see if they can get a hit.
Yeah. That's why I soak my tips in, in alcohol or acid.
Acid.
Yeah.
So Gibbs, we got to talk about probably the really strange defense that they offer up. Basically, what they say is that Peter's death was in retaliation against his uncle.
It's like the Sopranos.
Yeah. I mean, this is like Sopranos type stuff, because his uncle Frank was a captain in the Bonanno crime family in New York City. You know, well known, big time crime family. And Frank had actually served a couple years in prison for loan sharking and extortion. And during the trial, the defense counsel actually told the jurors that Frank had been indicted for murder. But that was not true. So I don't think it was a lie, but they incorrectly said that. But the biggest thing to me, and I guess the most interesting part of this part of the story, is that Frank Porco had a nickname. And his nickname with the mob was the fireman.
The fireman.
So that's very strange when Peter is killed with a fireman's axe. And you see that all the time. They don't just say he's killed with an axe. He's killed with a fireman's axe.
Yeah. And that's where Frank worked, right?
Yeah, he did. He served with the New York City Fire Department. But again, what else? I don't know what else the defense could offer up. Because as we've talked about, a lot of this evidence was very, very damning against Christopher. There's no doubt when you start to put the timelines together and all of that.
The different witnesses that they had. I think it's tough to prove otherwise.
Yeah, and that's not even all the stuff that we talked about that he did that was weird or semi-criminal leading up to the murder. This is just the evidence around the day before and the day of the murder.
Even during the trial, Christopher's brother, when he's on the stand, he does not paint a good picture of his brother. And he really gets the attention of the jury. He even speaks about how Christopher was aware of the life insurance policies. So even on the stand, his brother talks about how Christopher was always trying to be something that he wasn't.
Yeah, I think he was always trying to convince people that he was better than what he really was, whether that was richer. I don't know what else it would be.
No, but you're right. I mean, if he was a better athlete than he was, a better whatever, he always wanted to portray to people that he was the top of whatever it was.
Yep.
But because of what his brother said, it hurt his case. Even with his mom, Christopher's mom, on stating that her son didn't do this to her, it didn't matter. I mean, what his brother said just really drove home the point. And of course, you have the police officers talking about what the mother originally said anyway, about how Christopher did it.
I told you in the beginning of this case, ladies and gentlemen, it started with the nod Joan Porco as she lay in the bed after the attack. Was it Christopher? She said yes. Using the master code to disarm the alarm when he went to his parents' house that morning, ladies and gentlemen, was like dropping his wallet at the crime scene. One is that Christopher Porco is guilty, or number two, that Christopher Porco is the unluckiest man on the face of the planet.
So there you have it. That's some of what the prosecution laid out, and I mean that, and that's just a tiny bit of it.
Yeah.
Obviously, they had a lot more.
Sums it up good though.
Yeah, it does for a little bit. I think the part he says at the end really sums it up. So he's either guilty or he's the unluckiest man in the world.
Right.
And you can say that about a lot of guilty people.
Sure.
Right. It's either they did all of these things and all this evidence that fits against them, or else they are so unlucky, it's unbelievable.
Exactly.
I don't think he was unlucky.
I don't think so either.
So Gibbs, I mean, we talked about the defense, and there wasn't a whole lot that they could do, I don't think. We've laid out most of the prosecution's case with the timelines and the toll booth people and all of that. The one thing we haven't talked about is they had a ticket from the toll booth in Albany. And there was a lot made about this ticket and the fact that it had Porco's DNA on it. But they were never able to conclusively prove that it did. But I think that stuck out in the jury's mind anyway, because it was viewed as kind of a critical piece in the prosecution's case, even though they really couldn't prove that it was 100% his DNA.
Well, and I think it probably was, because you can say something in court, right? And they can say, we're going to strike that out, right? But you already said it, and juries aren't going to forget it. Right. You can tell a jury, forget that you heard that, but you know what? They heard it, and they're going to remember it.
And I don't know that they did strike it, but the fact that they said, you know, there's a good chance, or we think it's, you know, his DNA, or yeah. but you have the toll booth operator at that exit in Albany placing him there.
Yeah. It's so, just kind of concretes it together.
Yeah, it kind of puts it together, even though they couldn't really nail it right down. So the prosecution rested their case on August 2nd, 2006. We talked about the defense a little bit. They rested or completed theirs on the 9th, I believe, because jury deliberations began on August 10th. And the jury came back with a decision very fast, Gibbs.
Which is never good for the defense.
No,
I
never.
Mean, really, it's never. That's a bad sign.
Usually.
I'd say 90% of the time.
Yeah, usually that's not very good for the defense. But it was so fast that Christopher's mother, Joan, had left the courtroom after, you know, everything was wrapped and the jury started deliberating. And she had either gone back to her hotel or she had gone somewhere to rest. She couldn't even get back in time once they called and said, oh my gosh, the jury's already done. She couldn't get back in time for them to read the decision.
So she didn't even get to hear the verdict.
No.
Live.
Yeah, my understanding is that she, I don't know how far away she was, but she couldn't get back that quick. But the jury delivers their verdict, and they find Christopher Porco guilty of second-degree murder of his dad, Peter, and attempted murder of his mother, Joan. So on December 12, 2006, the judge sentenced Porco to 50 years to life on each count, which totaled a minimum of 50 years in prison. The judge actually had a quote saying, I fear very much what happened in the early morning hours of November 15th is something that could happen again. By saying that, that tells me the judge was convinced of the evidence that he heard, right? To make a statement like that.
Yeah, I agree.
So Porco was initially sent to a correctional facility in the town of Fishkill. And then ultimately he was moved to Clinton Correctional Facility, which is Dannemora. Now he'll be eligible for parole in December of 2052.
He'll be out. I wonder how old he'll be.
I don't know, but if we're still doing the podcast, I know this is what you're going to say. Reach out to us, email us.
Yeah, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about this.
We'll still be doing the podcast in 2052. So there's a couple of things I want to talk about before we wrap this up. So I want to play a clip from some of the jurors that sat on at the trial.
Was very compelling. Circumstantial though it was very compelling.
There was too much that fit into the timeline that we had, and he had no alibi.
I still believe that he thinks he did nothing wrong, and he showed no remorse.
So they were convinced, right? You can tell by what they're saying.
I'm convinced.
I'm convinced too, but it's that last lady really, you know, kind of sums it up for me that he shows no remorse, and he didn't show any remorse even at his sentencing, because I wanted to play it a little bit earlier, but I'm going to play this clip of the verdict because there's something that I like in it.
Paperwork State of New York against Christopher Porco, count one, murder in the second degree. What's your verdict?
Guilty.
Count two, attempted murder in the second degree. Your verdict?
Guilty.
You could see blood rush up the neck of Christopher, and so he showed no outward emotion. And then the court officers immediately came behind him and told him to put his hands behind his back, and you couldn't hear anything in the room except those handcuffs clicking on.
I just like that. I like the sound of those handcuffs
going on
his wrists. So the other thing I wanted to talk about was a little bit about parricide, right? I mean, parricide is when somebody murders their mother, father, some close relative. And that's what happened in this case with Christopher Porco. And there were some stats that I found very interesting. And it said that less than 2% of all homicides in the U.S. are parricides. Now, the overwhelming majority of offenders in these type of parricide murders are adults. But there are a lot of juveniles where this happens as well. I mean, it was said that 25% where the father is killed involved a juvenile, and about 17% where the mother is killed involved a juvenile. So we're talking under 18 years of age.
Right.
Now, here's some statistics that I thought were interesting as well. Parents that are killed, they tend to be white, with white mothers comprising 75% of the victims. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
I mean, that's a very high percentage. And white fathers comprising 68% of the victims. So I know those are weird numbers, but you got to figure sometimes, a lot of times they're killed in together.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking. Males are much more likely to commit these types of murders. I think you could say that about any type of murder, though. So I don't think that's strange at all. But 87% of the offenders are male. But what is strange to me is that of these 87% of males that commit parricide, they tend to come from middle and upper class families. So this is not something that you see in the lower economic stratus, I guess. That's what I took away from that.
I mean, it's a good point.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No, I mean.
I appreciate your approval.
I do.
It means a lot to me.
I'm just saying.
All right, Gibbs, before we wrap this up, two more things. First of all, I've got to play this clip of Joan, because we've talked about Joan throughout, and how she remained convinced that Christopher was not the person that killed Peter and attacked her with the axe.
With every ounce of my being, I cannot accept that Christopher could have or would have chosen to butcher us. I believe him to be innocent.
So she believes it.
Only a mom.
Yeah.
Only a mom could say something like that.
Right. And you can hear in her voice, and if you see pictures of her, I mean, you know, she's...
Oh, devastating.
Yeah. Her face, and obviously they had to reconstruct it, but it caused her to, I'm sure, not talk the way she did
right before
the attack.
But again, I mean, only a mom would come to... a son's defense, a kid, a daughter too, defense, even when they did something so terrible.
So again, Gibbs, a case that a lot of people wanted us to cover. It is a very interesting case, heartbreaking as well, because, you know, you've got this mom who almost suffered twice, right? She was viciously attacked, disfigured, maimed for life.
Right.
And then the second part of it is she doesn't believe that her son has done it, and he's convicted and, you know, sent away for probably most of his life. He'd be pretty old if he ever were to get out. So in that sense, I felt horrible for her, because it was almost like she was victimized in her mind. She was victimized the first time for sure, but she's feeling victimized about the whole trial and incarceration and all that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually surprised that the defendant, you know, Christopher didn't, when he saw the way that this was going to shake down when the evidence was put out, surprised he didn't flip it and say that, you know, the reason he did do this, but the reason he did it was because his dad abused him.
Well, that, and I think that's what you see in most parasite situations.
Yeah.
Right. So think, you know, we haven't done the Menendez brothers. We will.
Oh, yeah.
But that was their big thing.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
We did it, but here's the reason why we did it.
Right.
But maybe some of that goes back to his wiring. And maybe he's not able to, we don't think that happened at all.
But
I'm saying is maybe his strategy. Wiring made it so that he was not able to even go down that path.
Yeah.
Right. Because that would make him look bad.
Right. And he doesn't want to look bad. Right.
We know that.
You. Yeah.
I'm just thinking out loud that maybe that's a big part of it. So that's the case of Christopher Porco. Like we said, a lot of people were asking for it. We like to give the people what they want.
We're people pleasers.
People pleasers. All right. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking. Tell everybody about a game that I've been playing recently called Two Dots. You know, primarily Two Dots is a puzzle-based game. You have to connect at least two dots of the same color to make a move. And then those connected dots are removed from the game area, and the dots above them drop down until they hit other dots or the floor beneath. But there's a variety of game modes. There's this really cool one called Scavenger Hunt, which is a really relaxing hidden object game. There's different levels to the game that are grouped into worlds, and it's very satisfying to move up. There's over 5,000 unique puzzles and fun levels. And with all the different gameplay modes, it really makes the gaming experience unique and exciting with every single puzzle. The visuals are amazing, and the in-game music I found to be very soothing. You can even challenge your friends on Facebook to make it competitive, link up and see how your dot skills match up. And best of all, it's free to download, and you don't need Wi-Fi to play it. You can play it offline as well. Think you have what it takes to solve some fun puzzles? Download Two Dots now for free on Android or iOS.